This is an Irreverent podcast. Check out irreverent.fm for shows from all our friends.
1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change, it's a podcast about seeking moral high ground, and it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.
Hello and welcome to Exvangelical, a show exploring the world inside and outside the evangelical subculture. I'm your host, Blake Chastain. Today I'm speaking to Sarah McCammon, author of the new book, The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah is national political correspondent for NPR, as well as co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. In this conversation, I talked to Sarah about her own personal experience growing up within evangelicalism, as well as how her background informed her role as a journalist covering the 2015-2016 campaign of Donald Trump. It's a very interesting conversation, and we'll get right to it. Before that, though, I want to let you know you can support this show via a paid subscription to the Post-Evangelical Post. Exvangelical is a production of the Post-Evangelical Post, which can be found at postevangelicalpost.com. You can find a link to that in the show notes. You can subscribe for $5 a month or $50 a year, and you will receive ad-free podcast feeds, exclusive writing, and some other things. In addition to that, I donate 25% of net proceeds to White Homework, an anti-racist educator, as well as the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. Learn more over at postevangelicalpost.com. You can also find a link to purchase the book from my bookshop over in the show notes as well. All right, let's get into it. My guest today is Sarah McCammon, national political correspondent for NPR, co-host of the NPR Politics podcast, and author of The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Blake. Good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. I'd like to start here at the beginning, and that entails learning a little bit about where you grew up and what your first sort of experiences with religion were like.
Sure. So I grew up in the Midwest, Kansas City, Missouri, in the 80s and 90s. I'm like almost as old as you can be and be a millennial. And I say in my book, I was born about 2 weeks after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated the first time. And I mention that because really, you know, in some ways, my life has paralleled a certain trajectory of the political movement that became intertwined with evangelicalism. And that's partly what the book is about. Mm-hmm. But the evangelicalism that I grew up exposed to, in many ways, I kind of had a flavor of different parts of the evangelical culture. Evangelicalism is a big movement. It's sometimes hard to define. And there are a lot of overlapping and intersecting parts of it. And so the church that I grew up in was charismatic. We believed in speaking in tongues and spiritual gifts, you know, things like miracles. You could pray for miracles. And sometimes we believed that God would, it was a non-denominational charismatic church, so not affiliated with a particular church hierarchy or structure or organization, just kind of independent. Then I went to a Christian school and the church I went to was on the Kansas side of the state line. If anybody knows Kansas City, it's in Kansas and Missouri. The Christian school was in Missouri. It was a small, kind of more to the fundamentalist side. People talk about what's the line between fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and I think of it more as a spectrum because really, we believed, my church and school believed basically the same things about salvation and the Bible, just different, slightly different ideas about certain aspects of that. But my school was a little bit more conservative in traditions of its, not necessarily belief system, almost its aesthetic, for lack of a better term. Like, girls at my school had to wear dresses, at least down to our we weren't quite as far to the fundamentalist side of the spectrum as some Christian schools in the area. There were some people who like didn't go to movies, and most people could go to movies, but it was kind of restricted. And so there was this, it was this big kind of, like I say, overlapping, intersecting mix of religious ideas, but they all centered around the idea that Jesus was the only way to God and the only way to salvation, that we were all sinners, and that the Bible was literally true, that most of us believed, I think everyone I knew believed that the earth was 6,000 to 10,000 years old and was directly created by God. And almost everybody I knew was a Republican. So that is it in a nutshell. There were small areas of disagreement, but we were, I think, had more in common than not. Then when I went to college, I went to an evangelical free college. And, you know, again, was in sort of this milieu of a lot of different evangelical kids from different specific churches and sub-traditions, but all united around essentially those same ideas.
Well, we had some parallel experiences in that I also grew up in the Midwest in the 80s. But whereas you had this charismatic experience, I was in United Methodist and sort of holiness-oriented type spaces. But interestingly, the thing that I think the way you describe this is that even with those differences in ways of worship and things like that, we can both still identify that as being understood as evangelical or having this evangelical experience.
Right.
What do you think? What was it? If it wasn't actually the religious things and it wasn't those beliefs, what else was it that could bind your experience and mine together as identifiably evangelical?
I mean, there was the religious belief, right? The theology was, I think, broadly, we're talking about conservative Protestantism. So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is more to it than that. And one of the things I talk about in the book, and I'm sure that a lot of your listeners will understand, is that they're, you know, growing up evangelical, especially during that time period, it very much was a sub. And while you and I could probably sit and talk about the Christian cartoons and TV shows and radio shows and books and magazines that we read and saw and listened to, they wouldn't all be the same, but there would probably be significant, you know, probably most evangelicals of our generation had some exposure to focus on the family and its vast universe of materials, many of which were for young, and many of which became, especially over time, along with some of Focus on the Family's affiliates, extremely political. And then, you know, there was like a whole, I described this in the book as a parallel universe, and that's a, you know, not an original term, but it really felt that way in a lot of ways. There was an entire kind of media infrastructure that is constructed around an evangelical child in that time period, books, magazines, movies, radio shows. So that your whole world, I mean, my whole world for the most part was existing within the evangelical universe. That might be more true for some people and less true for some people, but I think it's a common theme among people I talk. There was, you know, not that much exposure to outside ideas, or when you were exposed to them, at least when I was exposed, they were sort of framed as worldly or other, the secular world. Something to be wary of, something to be protected from, something to be cautious of. Now, if I don't know if you went to private school or Christian school or public school, Blake, can I ask?
I went to public school.
So you had some exposure there. So it would be a little different for you. But, you know, a lot of evangelical kids were homeschooled or Christian school. And even if you go to public school, I don't know how much that experience matches your. I felt like I was always being told sort of how to, you know, to view the world at a remove in a way.
Yeah, to be in, but not of the world. For the public school folks like me, there were instances of, say, either Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Fellowship of Christian Students, see you at the poll. There were still ways that were absolutely framed as being countercultural and being resistant to the world's corrupting influences. Even though it wasn't something that my parents hadn't placed me in a private school. Those types of things were things that you could either voluntarily do if you were, a zealous kid was, or that would be available to evangelical parents or students.
Right.
Absolutely.
And if not that, then there was usually youth group and often church camp. And
was the youth group culture, I mean, I felt like it was at the zenith in like the 90s, and I could swear that there were like Newsweek articles and stuff when I was in the 90s and about, you know, kids on fire for Jesus and profiles of Cornerstone Festival and things like that.
Definitely. You know, it's funny, even at Christian school, we did See You at the Pole, which to me is hilarious in retrospect, because the whole idea was that you were being countercultural and standing up and saying, you know, I'm not afraid to say I'm a Christian, which is, you know, actually at my school, you would have been afraid to say you were not a Christian. It was also about a public testimony, you know, standing outside and being seen as standing up for Christianity. And the thing that I think is so interesting about that in retrospect, whether you're in public, private, or Christian school, or, is that at that time in the 90s, according to data from, you know, a mix of sources, but Robbie Jones at the Public Religion Research Institute has done a really good job of kind of culling it together. And he says about 1 in 4 Americans, or just shy of 1 in 4 Americans, were white evangelicals. So I had this sense of being, and I think something like See You at the Pole is a good example of it, of being countercultural, of being this sort of part of this, you know, oppressed minority, for lack of a better word, when really we were arguably the largest religious tradition in the country, or right up there with Roman Catholicism, and hugely gaining in political power. And yet we had this idea, you know, that so much of the messaging around, you know, fighting against the decline of the culture, returning the country to being a Christian nation, so much of it sort of presented us as embattled, you know, something unusual, which we really were not. In fact, it was quite a powerful movement and still is today.
As being sort of on the ropes in order to maintain that level of zeal.
Yeah. And I mean, it is, you know, much of pop culture was not driven by evangelicals. I mean, conservative Christianity did not have an elite place in pop culture. So I guess, you know, there was some truth in that, but we were by no means a tiny group.
Right. Yeah. You describe one period that was very enlightening for you, even though you did live a sort of separate life and but not of the old type of Christian evangelical upbringing. One of the first forays sort of into the world that you describe was your time as a Senate page. And that was actually during the Clinton administration, correct?
Yeah, 1998.
Yeah, which I certainly recall as being a time when there was a lot of talk about morality and within evangelicalism, how it related to politics and how the level to which Clinton was vilified for a lot of reasons. And I'm curious what sort of that experience being in that place, that sort of locus of power and everything, how did viewing and being a part of that world as a page inform how you saw the world, and did it lead to any cognitive dissonance?
I think, trying to remember my 16, 17 year old mind, I think that I went to Washington. I mean, I know that I went there in part because my family was, you know, part of, influenced by this larger movement among in evangelicalism to, you know, toward political activism. We saw our mission not just as sort of sharing the good news of the gospel with people, but also, we felt that had political implications. We felt that we had the truth and that there was a right way to live, and that it was our job as Christians to promote that through the political process. And so, I think the thinking, you know, what I was taught in my Christian school was that America was a Christian nation, and that problems that we had in our country were because of a decline in morality, because of a decline in Christian faith. And so going to Washington, becoming involved in politics, working to, you know, conservatives to political office who would ultimately, the goal among so many people I knew was to get enough Supreme Court justices on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade, which when I was a kid was something that was seen as a very far off distant goal, but something that would eventually be achieved. And so I think going to Washington, being part of the locus of power was in our minds, it was connected with a Christian mission. And, you know, that was the kind of rhetoric I was hearing. At the same time, I was a teenager I thought it was exciting to go to DC.
Sure. And absolutely
be around powerful, important people and see what was going on and get away from home. But what I found when I got there, not only was it the time, the Clinton Lewinsky era, and that was in the air. And I definitely have a lot of memories, which I share in the book, of sort of how my community reacted. But it also just personally was a moment where I realized just how different I was and where I felt like a fish out of water. I had been sort of swaddled in this conservative Christian world where everybody thought the same way and behaved the same way. And suddenly I had a teacher who taught evolution. I had classmates who were having sex. Mm-hmm. I was around people of different faiths. And it was kind of eye-opening for me to see this world I kind of knew was out there, but to see it up close and just realize how differently other people lived.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up going to, after that experience, this was, you ended up going to an evangelical school for college. What was that a foregone conclusion that you would go to an evangelical or a Christian school? Or did you consider state schools and other options?
It was, I'll be honest, that was my parents' wish. I wanted to elsewhere. I was interested in journalism from a young age, and I grew up in Missouri, which has one of the best journalism schools in the country. But my parents were concerned that, as my mom put it, you need to go to a school with a Christian worldview.
Mm-hmm.
She was concerned that I would absorb bad ideas in her mind if I went to a secular college. And so, well, it wasn't like a categorical prohibition. It was a really, really strong recommendation, at least, that I go to no one ever came out and said, you cannot go to a secular school, but it was strongly discouraged. And I think I remember sort of arguing with my parents about this. And, my younger sister went to a state school. She's a few years young. I think my mom said, she was interested in nursing. She said, well, she's interested in nursing. You're interested in politics and journalism, and you need to have, you need to study this from a Christian worldview. So it was sort of a case by case basis. But, I wound up going to an evangelical college in the Chicago area. And, it was in a lot of ways, it was a cool experience. I had a lot of professors who were wonderful and thoughtful, and had many of them had very complex Christian faiths that they'd arrived. Some of them were really wonderful scholars. It was a mix of people, but I, in some ways, I think going to a Christian college expanded my worldview a little bit, because I was able to, it wasn't a fundamentalist school. There were plenty of professors who had, at least if you talked to them privately, they were wrestling with certain things, like wrestling with creationism, for example.
Yeah.
And just seeing that up close and knowing that there were different ways of being Christian was helpful for me, as I was, very scared of doing anything that would violate what I'd been taught, but also really experiencing this cognitive dissonance and wanting to try to answer these questions and look beyond the evangelical world. Maybe almost a gateway drug to further exploration. And if I'd gone to a secular school and been plugged into like a Fellowship of Christian Athletes, or I wasn't an athlete, but something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how it would have gone. I don't know if I would have come out more or less religious than I did.
Right, right. And that's an interesting point. I have spoken to a couple of people on the show about, they went to a secular school, but they got involved in Campus Crusade and they stayed very evangelical even while they were at a state school. That's such an interesting wrinkle to that phase of life for people who are raised in evangelicalism and then go to an evangelical school or a state school, and what stays with them and what doesn't. I don't know whether you want to name your school or anything like that. We can leave that. I'm just curious because
I named it in the book.
Yeah. I went from the Chicago area. I went back to Indiana, where I was originally from, to Indiana Wesleyan. The reason I didn't choose any Christian school was it was just too close to home. but I think you went to Trinity. Yeah.
No, I don't mind saying that. I went to Trinity International, which sounds like a made-up name, and it doesn't exist anymore as an undergrad college. Just recently, the seminary there, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, is pretty well known in the evangelical world. And I was just at the small undergrad college, which is much less well known. And I just because I'd actually heard about it from a friend of my dad's who worked at the Family Research Council and recommended it as I think that maybe he'd had an intern or somebody who knew who went there. But it was close enough. It was, you know, about an 8-hour drive from Kansas City. I could get easy flights. You know, one of the things I love about growing up evangelical is, you know, my dad was very into like Josh, I think it was Josh McDowell.
No. Yeah, the evidence demands a verdict. And
yes, he was. But who was who was the like Dave Ramsey before Dave Ramsey?
Oh,
the Crown Financial Concepts people.
Yes, I'm blanking on it in the moment. Yeah,
it wasn't Josh McDowell. But my dad was very influenced by this sort of like anti-debt movement in evangelicalism, which is Dave Ramsey is like the best known version of that today. But that's been around for which if you can do it is great advice, actually. But not feasible for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so my charge was to go to a Christian college, but to not have any debt, which is like really hard to achieve because there aren't any state schools that are. So I went where I got a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then did you go directly into journalism after that? Or like what was the path for you to where you are now, I guess?
Yeah, I was unsure for a long time what I wanted to do. I mean, I was interested in journalism from a pretty young age. I wrote for the Kansas City Star teen page, high school newspaper. But I was never sure. And I actually started college studying history. I don't know why. I just liked it and quickly realized that there wasn't really a career path there unless I wanted to go get a PhD. And I fortunately was smart enough to do that. Because
I'm a history major. So
did you get a PhD?
No, I did not. Because it would have been during the recession and I knew a lot of American religious history profs or would be profs with no job prospects. So.
I mean, God bless anyone who can make it work. But I in fact, my history professor said, don't do this to yourself. So
yes.
I started thinking again about journalism. I kind of wanted to be in a space, you know, I always loved writing and reading and learning. And I wanted to be in a space where I was doing that kind of thing. But I really only had like a vague notion of that. I think I flirted with the idea of going into politics, but I also was like increasingly uneasy about certain aspects of evangelicalism. And that included the political project. I just felt like, you know, I was uneasy about the pressure to pick a team and decide and know things for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but then advocate for ideas that I was supposed to be so confident about. I felt like I had a lot more questions than answers. And I think in retrospect, although I don't believe I would have articulated it this way at the time, as I think about myself at that age, one of the things that I really liked about journalism that drew me to it was the freedom to ask questions and the pursuit of multiple perspectives, trying to understand the world, because I felt like this was the thing I wanted to do most and needed to do most, which was to just try to understand the world as it was without being told, you know, here's a systematic theology you have to get your head around or you're going to hell,
mm-hmm.
you know, or without being told like, most experts believe that the earth is not 6,000 years old, but we know that it is because it says so in this book. And here are all the ways you can do mental gymnastics to convince yourself of it. You know, I was tired of the mental gymnastics. I just wanted to like have the freedom to simply, this sounds so like high and mighty. I don't mean it to, but I just wanted to have the freedom to kind of look at the world as it was, gather information and try to make up my own mind because mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I'd been allowed to do that. And journalism felt like a place where I could do that. Certainly journalists don't do it perfectly. And that's a whole other side of our conversation we could have, but there is an ideal in journalism of doing this. And that, in retrospect, really appealed to me. I mean, I remember having conversations with my mother about like, she thought I should go work for World Magazine, you know, a conservative evangelical publication, which I should say has done some really good work on some of the systematic problems in churches and has done some good self-reflection. I'm not dragging on World Magazine, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I just knew from a young age that I wanted to be in a space that was less ideological.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that was kind of, and I found myself, you know, first at a newspaper, and then I just became obsessed with public radio and was lucky enough to kind of fall into a job at a small station in Nebraska. And one thing led to another, and I'm still doing it.
Great.
So,
Yeah. The way you phrase that, as far as wanting to be able to have the freedom to ask questions and not have to choose ideologically, that does exclude almost all evangelical outlets. if that's what you value and what you want to have the freedom to be able to do as a producer or a journalist.
1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change, it's a podcast about seeking moral high ground, and it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.
I want to actually jump ahead a bit and talk about some of your work later on as you're established as a journalist, because you were actually on assignment to cover the Trump campaign in 2015-2016, and we're also you recount in the book that you were actually in the ballroom where evangelical support for Trump really coalesced in June 2016. That moment is really starting to become immortalized in a fashion that's similar to the 1980 Reagan arena event where he told a group of evangelicals, "I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you and what you're doing." It feels like some of the accounts of the importance of that event are starting to, you know, it's starting to get to that level, I think, the way Ann Nelson and other journalists have framed it. What was it? I mean, I'm just so curious. What was it like to be there in the room and see that, knowing that you've had this experience growing up, you've gone through over a decade of being out in the world now? What was it like to see that play out and to cover it as a journalist?
Well, I was afraid I was going to get kicked out because I cannot go into detail, but someone let me in. And there was maybe one other reporter in that room, maybe more, but not many. It was not really open to the press. I got permission, but I did not sneak in, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
But nonetheless, there might have been people who wouldn't. But once I was in, you know, it was wild. I mean, it was a room full of some of the most important evangelicals of lives. I remember seeing Gary Bauer there. All of the, you know, anti-abortion, pro-life movement leaders were there. Many of them were there. And then a lot of people I'd never heard of, because, you know, the evangelical world is just so big.
Mm-hmm.
There was a smaller clip that like leaked out on Twitter, I think that same day, of like a smaller group meeting that I wasn't. But I believe in that meeting, they were, you know, praying with Trump. It was fascinating to be in this space and realize that like what was happening. And it was pretty clear, really, that what was going to happen, right? I mean, Trump was, for all intents and purposes, the presumptive nominee at this point. There had been all of this hand-wringing, I think, in the press and elsewhere about what are white evangelicals going to do, but Trump had been ahead in most of the polls, in most of the primaries, and with a few exceptions, for months. While some evangelical leaders, you know, might have said they were supporting him reluctantly, most of them were at this point, or at least they were about to. And I think that moment gave them an opportunity to say, he met with us, he's going to do the things we want him to do. You know, he talked about getting rid of the Johnson, you know, the requiring churches to be separate from politics in order to keep their tax exempt status. He, I think, released or promised to release a larger list of prospective Supreme Court justices that day, which is something he'd done. He'd released a partial list before. But he really leaned into a lot of the issues like abortion and the Supreme Court that these leaders cared about and had always cared about. And I think this sort of cemented that alliance in a big way.
Right, right. And right around this time is, this is going to be self-referential for a second. I apologize. But I timed my podcast to premiere the following month with the July RNC, the Republican National Convention. And there had already been a lot of people who had started questioning evangelical political orthodoxy in a lot of different ways. You had figures like Rachel Held Evans and all sorts of others that were starting to occupy this space. And then after Trump's election, which surprised so many people, then evangelical as a hashtag and other things started to really take off in a way that I don't mm-hmm. think would have probably happened in the same way if it wasn't for that sort of social catalyst.
I agree. That's the word I use too. I say this isn't about Trump, but Trump catalyzed it.
Right.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that those things have been present in evangelicalism for a long time. And there are people that we can identify as predecessors, as people who've questioned these types of orthodoxies in all sorts of ways. But this particular moment was just a confluence of social media being mature and politics being what it was and mm-hmm. a handful of other things. I'm curious what, given your personal experience as well as your position as a journalist, what drew you to this topic and made you want to cover it in this capacity where you're providing elements of memoir as well as journalistic reporting?
In some ways, it was an acceptance of a reality I found myself in quite by accident. I had spent so many years trying to, you know, by 2015, 2016, I'm, you know, in my mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And I had spent, you know, a good decade of my career trying to just be a good journalist and trying to, of course, I had this evangelical background and I would, you know, sometimes hear stories about, you know, various political debates. Although in some ways it felt like a lot of the big issues had sort of faded, like the same-sex marriage decision happened and that started to kind of put that issue to rest. Abortion was kind of at a stalemate in a lot for a long time and a lot of, there weren't that many debates about, I feel like the creationism versus intelligent design debate had kind of died down. So it wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe I wasn't paying as close of attention, but like in my work as a reporter, I was covering things like agriculture and water quality. And then I was covering, you know, like the Iowa caucuses, but I wasn't spending a lot of time thinking about my evangelical background
mm-hmm.
until 2015, 16. And it was like, suddenly I couldn't avoid thinking about it. I was assigned to the Republican campaign, the Republican primary.
Mm-hmm.
I go in expecting to cover like the Jeb Bush nomination, and we all know what happened there. And then, you know, I wind up covering a whole bunch of, you know, there was that huge slate of candidates, but ultimately it all lands on Trump and it's all about Trump. And it ends up being, the story is, what is the white evangelical base of the Republican Party going to do about this? And so I had no choice but to cover it. I was also fascinated by it, having this personal background
mm-hmm.
and hearing these names, you know, seeing figures like Jerry Falwell and, you know, Ralph Reed, and, seeing their names coming up and others. It was fascinating. And I was really fascinated by talking to the rank and file voters about how they were making sense of all this. And so after the 2016 election, or really close to the 2016 election, I was doing a story, white evangelical women and some of the wrestling that some of them were experiencing after the Access Hollywood video was released. Mm. And I came across the ex-evangelical hashtag at that time. Somebody mentioned it. And I just started paying attention because I felt it was just this strange overlap intersection of like the world I'd come from and the world I found myself covering as a journalist. And at times it was like really fascinating, and I really felt like I had something to say because I sort of spoke the language and sort of knew all the Bible verses and all mm-hmm. the references and all the plays. But other times it started to feel kind of exhausting because it's like, you know, your whole personal backstory is like in a way wrapped up with what you're doing for. And so, you know, I thought I just kind of I was watching the work that you and others were doing in these spaces and noticing that more and more people were having these conversations out in public. And I agree, because this confluence of social media and politics, I think, really propelled some of these conversations. I just became really, really fascinated with, you know, at the same time, a lot of people were asking me about my story. How do you see what's happening given your own experience? And I just thought, you know, maybe I'll write a book about that, because it's such a long conversation. And I never wanted to just write a pure memoir, but I you know, I really loved having the opportunity to tell my story in conversation with other people's. But I also like wanted, it felt like there was something happening. It kind of felt like a movement. And I wanted to write about that with the perspective of somebody who knows that world, you know? I mean, there have been plenty of sort of outsider books written about white evangelicalism, and that's great. That's fine. I admit. And insiders as well. But I there's something about having lived it that brings a different perspective. And I know that's part of why you're writing your book as well.
Right. Yeah. That's fascinating. And your book definitely highlights, you know, over the last decade, we've sort of had this influx of new types of language to talk about these things, terms like deconstruction, which, like, for better or worse, that's a sort of shared vocabulary. People know at least what you're signaling when you say something like that. And your interviews that are throughout the book highlight the various sort of common threads that I've also seen as, like, these broader patterns that crop up in individuals' stories. Things like purity culture, racism, sexism, homophobia, and transphobia, this penchant towards authoritarians. And all of the sorts of cognitive dissonance that can go into trying to reconcile those things with your inherited worldview and then your experience of the world. Throughout your reporting of this book, or even throughout your time as a journalist leading up to working on this, are there any types of those triggers or catalysts for deconstruction for people that you found surprising? Or are there any other? Because I can definitely name the Trump election as a very common one. And for me, like, I was in Christian college during the run up to the war in Iraq, so for me that was a big catalyst. Have you seen any others that we can point to of this is that?
I think those are all those things. I also, in my reporting, We mentioned racism, and there's a chapter on that, but people brought up specifically the response of some of their churches to the killing of George Floyd, and also the Ferguson, Missouri, you know, to the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri several years before. And I think, you know, there was a sense among some of the people I interviewed that the churches hadn't responded with the gravity that was necessary for those moments. Also the COVID, I came across some people who felt like their churches kind of broke apart, or at least were insensitive to the health needs of their congregations at that. And I'm sure there will be more to come, but I think you know, one of the other larger themes is sort of a rejection on the part of much of the movement and many of its leaders of secular authority. And that includes scientific authority, you know, the idea that we kind of have our own alternative facts. You know, if something violates the narrative, it will be rejected. And I think that, you know, I think that actually is part of what shapes a lot of the around even like sexuality, you know, the idea that people, their self-report is, I have felt different since I was a kid. You know, you hear this from queer people all the time. I knew that I was gay from a young, you know, I talk about my grandpa in the book who came out late in life, and he told me something like that. But you tell that to some evangelicals who believe that being homosexual is a sin, and it's just like data that cannot compute because it doesn't fit the narrative. And so, you know, I think fundamentally one of the problems is a lack of responsiveness to new information and information that contradict those preconceived ideas. And I get that. I mean, it can be scary to have to change your your belief system.
Really?
But I think that, again, going back to like why I love journalism, that's kind of part of being a thinking person who is mm-hmm. present in the world, is taking it in and responding accordingly.
Right, right. So I have a sort of member of the media question to jump off of that. So this is for someone who is whose full-time work is journalism. This isn't to pigeonhole you, and this isn't a gotcha thing as far as a member of the media. But how do you feel as a person in the media that coverage of either evangelical or now ex-evangelical perspectives and experiences have really changed over the last decade or so?
I think there are more people with evangelical backgrounds in journalism and political and religion journalism, and I think that's good. I mean, I know some of them are my friends. Mm-hmm. And I think there are more and more people like yourself who are sort of not exactly a journalist, but in these sort of public spaces, podcasts, talking about these issues. And so I think there is more, or at least there are more places, if you're someone who is aware of, you know, the sort of post-evangelical groundswell and looking for, you know, either an ex-evangelical community or a progressive Christian outlet or whatever the case may be. There are places to go now, and there really weren't to go, even maybe 10 years ago. But, you know, the mainstream media, I don't like, you know, I'm not a media critic. I think when I was younger, there were times I felt like evangelicals were all kind of lumped together and talked about as if they're one monolithic movement. And I think there's still some truth to that. Although if you look at data, 80% of white evangelicals do vote for the same guy and pretty enthusiastically. You know, there's some truth in that. And it's, you know, it's a convenient label. When you're talking about a country with millions and millions of people, you have to sort of talk about different voting blocks, and evangelicals are a definable and pretty predictable voting block. At the same time, because it is such a big movement, there is a variety of points of view and expression. And, you know, I hope that's something that comes across in my book, just that there are, you know, there are people who continue to identify as, you know, some kind of evangelical or at least Christian from this background, who hold different views. And even within the movement, there are like we started out talking about, so many different sort of streams of theology and expression. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily expect like a journalist at a national newspaper to delve into that in a ton of detail all the time. But I do think I'm glad that we're able to talk about it and that there are more kind of niche spaces to talk about it, because it really does. I think, you know, to have a really full picture of what evangelicalism is, it's important to understand that it isn't just one thing, like any group of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And thank you for fielding that question. That was not, like I said, to have you be representative for every person in the media or any of that. I was just curious, given your position, as well as the fact that you've written a whole book about this and clearly have a lot of concern and care for this as a topic. And that's just always something that's always a perennial interest to me, is how these things are presented in those publications that have broad reach and all of the various assumptions that readers have or voters or however you want to divide people. So thank you for entertaining that. I do have a couple of...
It's a good question. It's totally fair.
Okay. I've really just got a couple of other questions, and they do sort of dovetail together. You do call the term ex-evangelical useful because of its specificity and complexity. I do also appreciate that you include stories and comments from people who don't identify with the term, and I think that's completely valid. As someone who's had a podcast with this term for, and you know, had it for better or worse for several years, I know that opinions about it have certainly changed. But if you're certainly enmeshed in various parts of the internet dedicated to these conversations, you know, the term evangelical is always up for debate. So why wouldn't the term ex-evangelical be up for debate too? I'm curious, you know, your book is titled The Ex-Evangelicals. Where do you relate to it? Where do you, like, How do you understand it? Is it a similar sort of thing as it's a valuable shorthand, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I think it's a valuable shorthand, and I think it, like, it doesn't say everything, but the no term can. I mean, put most simply, to me, an ex-evangelical is somebody who used to be an evangelical who no longer identifies that way for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. That might mean they're an atheist. It might just mean that they're like a liberal evangelical and they don't like that word anymore. Or it might mean that they've converted to something else. It could mean any number of things. But I think what it gets at is that there is a subculture, and there's a shared set of experiences, and there's often a shared journey out, even though each person's is different and there are different specific reasons why different people evolve religiously. But I think, you know, there are some overarching themes. We just talked about them, and you see them a lot in these spaces. And I don't claim to have addressed every single one, but you know,
it's such a broad topic. How could you?
Yeah. But yeah. I don't know about you, but like when I'm somewhere in the wild and I meet somebody who grew up like Southern Baptist or went to Christian school, like I've had this experience more than once of kind of being like the two ex-evangelical kids in the corner, like bonding over, you know, shared trauma, or just like talking about Adventures in Odyssey or whatever the case may be. It's like you have this shared language and this shared experience. And also sort of a shared feeling of sometimes being a fish out of water in the real world if you've been really shaped by this subculture. So I think that's why I find it useful, because it communicates not only who you are, but where you've been, and we're all shaped by where we've been. But yeah, I did want to talk about people who don't necessarily identify with the term, because I think there are people that wouldn't use that term that kind of fall into the same category of having, you know, similar experiences of conscientiously moving away from these evangelicals. And many of them have, I mean, I don't really care how people, I didn't use that word in before I heard it a few ago. But when I heard it, I was like, well, that is actually very, I think a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think it's a surprise that I agree. But I also accept just, and I was glad to see that you had, that you gave voice to the criticisms, because I think the criticisms are valid. And if you don't make space for those, then you are not sort of doing that thing that, if you're only finding the things that reinforce your worldview, then that may not serve you in the long run. My final question really revolves around, again, another sort of aspect of our social conversations that happen sort of in this broad general sense, which is, especially since the January 6th insurrection, we've seen discussions of Christian nationalism become more prominent over the last several years. And that conversation has absolutely been elevated and started to be focused on, and within various media circles for the last several years. From your vantage point, where do you see conversations about religion and society going? Do you think that those terms will be useful, or do you think there's going to be a more openness about how religion and society, religion and politics commingle and affect one another? Like, where do you see those types of conversations going in the near future?
They're interesting conversations because, I mean, I'm still working out what I think about pieces of them. I think there's some things that are really clear. Like, I don't think you should use the government to force other people to hold your religious beliefs or act as if they do, mm-hmm. right? And that's a principle that I think most people could sign off on. But what does that look like in reality? And what is the line between saying we live in a pluralistic society, a nation set up with the idea of separation of church and state, where everyone is free to express their religion, which I think is something that I hope that most, if not all, Americans would sign on to, because it's in our Constitution. But then what's the line between that and the idea that a person brings their whole self to their political pursuits and to the voting booth, and you know, a person doesn't have to leave their values, including their religious values, at the door when they vote. And I think that is a fair argument. I think it gets very messy, though, how exactly what that looks like. But I think And I think that's kind of, that's where a lot of the conversation is going. It is very clear, though, if you look at the rhetoric in some of the Christian nationalist spaces, there are now people who are openly identifying as Christian nationalists. And there are people who are openly saying that Christianity should be prioritized, in that Christianity, you know, if you look at Robbie Jones's polling at Public Religion Research Institute, there's a large overlap between white evangelicals and holding the sentiment that being a Christian is important to being an American. And that is not a belief that all evangelicals hold. Mm-hmm. I have spoken to evangelicals who don't. And when I was growing up, I think there would have been more people who would say, no, you have to choose your faith for yourself. It has to be voluntary. It can't be. But I think that idea is becoming a little muddled in evangelical circles. I think there's a sort of an ascendance of Christian nationalistic ideas. And I think that's very concerning, because if we believe in democracy and we believe in the Constitution, mm-hmm. then we have to be committed to religious pluralism, to allowing everyone to have their religious belief, express it or not. But I acknowledge that, like, not everyone who says, I'm a Christian, or I'm Jewish, or I'm Muslim, and therefore I believe X about, you know, all those religions have teachings about helping other people, and therefore, you know, I want to vote for politicians that I believe will help the poor and make us a better society, like, because I'm a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or whatever the case. That seems okay. Like, I don't want to sit here and say you should never, ever infuse your religious and spiritual beliefs with your political ones. But I think we should think hard about how we're doing that and how much we're doing that, and to what extent the things that we're trying to promote in the public sphere might be specific to our religion, and how much are we stepping on the toes of someone else by doing so. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't have the answers for that, but that is something that I think about a lot, and I think that a lot of conversations I'm seeing are kind of revolving around.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, I really appreciated talking to you about your book. I think it's another great addition to the growing body of texts that focus on these things and how it relates to, as you said, many of our experiences and informing our present, as well as understanding our past and everything that entails. The book, again, is titled The Exvangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah, thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great talking with you. And I look forward to reading yours, too.
That'll do it for today's episode. Thank you for listening to Exvangelical. You can find more episodes over at exvangelicalpodcast.com, or head on over to postevangelicalpost.com to subscribe to my Substack and support the show directly. Talk to you soon.
1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change, it's a podcast about seeking moral high ground, and it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.